This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 23rd, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, news from around the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, news from around the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, Christopher Wiley, the Facebook and Cambridge Analytica whistleblower from Victoria, came home to British Columbia last week. The Breaker was at the Extraordinary Future Conference in Vancouver, and we'll bring you a portion of his appearance. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those who deserve it. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or are the local government elections in British Columbia going to be a real experiment in democracy? October 20th will be the second time that citizens will elect mayors and councillors to four-year terms. Election day is now a month earlier than normal, but will that be enough time for Vancouverites, for example, to get to know all 158 people who are seeking public offices? Since 2014, the media industry in BC has shrunk. There are fewer reporters, fewer photographers, and fewer outlets, and that means less light will be shone on those who want to make laws and put their hands in the public purse for the next 4 years. Social media remains a force, but after the 2016 U.S. presidential election, can you really trust everything you see on Facebook and Twitter? Certainly not if it's anonymous. So, reader beware. The campaign period began officially on September 22nd. New rules against corporate and union donations mean there will be less money for candidates to advertise. Or will they just find new loopholes, or break the laws and hope that nobody notices? The local government elections are competing for your attention with the upcoming mail-in referendum on whether to change from first-past-the-post elections to a proportional representation system. While electoral reform could be a good thing, the NDP government is not doing anybody a favor with the timing. The referendum should have been on every local government ballot to save time and money, or it should have been delayed until March or April of next year. Every time Donald Trump burps, it'll distract the public, especially if he criticizes Canada. And the real curveball? Well, on October 17th, a milestone in Canadian law, business, and culture. It will become legal to buy, sell, and smoke marijuana. Whether you are for or against the peddling and puffing of pot, you will not be able to escape the media coverage of the end of this prohibition. The only local government candidates that get attention that day might just be the ones who light up a joint for a photo op. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Star Online, Terrence Tan reports, Malaysian Anti-Corruption Commission not ruling out more charges against Najib. Deputy Commissioner Azam Baki is not ruling out the possibility that Najib Razak and his wife will face further graft charges. The New Straits Times, in quoting sources, reported on September 18th that Rosma, the former Prime Minister's wife, is set to face up to 20 criminal charges, as investigators have completed their probe into an alleged Rosma file, which was reopened soon after the Barisan National Government was defeated in the 14th general election. Earlier on September 20th, Najib pleaded not guilty to four graft charges. Najib was charged under the Anti-Money Laundering Act and Anti-Terrorism Financing Act of 2001. The former premier was also granted bail of $1 million and two sureties. In ABC News Australia, Steve Canan and Dunya Karadzic report, serial conman Eddie Kang up to old tricks, ripping off vulnerable students. One of Australia's most notorious scam artists is continuing to run a business that rips off vulnerable students while he is out on bail, appealing his conviction and sentence. Eddie Kang was sentenced to 12 months in prison in March 2017 after he was convicted of 22 counts of fraud and misleading conduct involving 11 foreign students who paid his companies to secure 457 visas. The jobs and the visas never eventuated. and the Korean-born businessman refused to refund the student's money, including payments worth tens of thousands of dollars. One of Kang's bail conditions states he must not file any visa applications using a company of which he is a sole director. An ABC investigation has uncovered evidence. The convicted fraudster continues to take money off foreign students under the false promise he will secure them visa and sponsored employment. In the Taiwan Times, Wang Zhuti reports, German experts propose turning unused nuclear plant in Taiwan into a theme park. German experts in nuclear power suggested that Taiwan can consider giving a new lease of life to the Lungmen nuclear power plant, better known as the fourth nuclear power plant, through transforming it into a theme park after it is decommissioned. According to Oscar Grosinger, former head of the Nuclear Energy Supervision and Radiation Protection Department in Germany, the Kalkar nuclear power plant in Germany was completed but never put into service before it was repurposed to become a theme park called Wunderland Kalkar. The amusement park, which boasts a spa, restaurants, and other attractions incorporating facilities originally built for the plant, receives approximately 600,000 visitors every year and is free from safety concerns, adding that its success can be emulated by the fourth nuclear power plant in Taiwan. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling, where we look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Mike Rugaway reports, Facebook will spend another $750 million in Prineville. Facebook said it will spend $750 million to build two more massive data centers on the outskirts of the tiny central Oregon town. The project will expand the company's complex to seven buildings and bring its total investment to the neighborhood of $2 billion. At 3.2 million square feet, Facebook's Prineville footprint will be the equivalent of putting 22 Costco stores in a community of just 10,000 people. The gigantic scale notwithstanding, data centers are not major employers. They are cavernous, dark, and mostly devoid of people, consisting of dozens or hundreds of rows of computer servers packed tightly together. Facebook said it will add as many as 100 jobs to Prineville to accommodate the expansion, lifting its total workforce past 350. But the tally includes a large number of security contractors. In the Seattle Times, Mike Lindblom reports, best place for self-driving semis. I-5 in Washington and Oregon, report says. The most productive corridor for self-driving trucks appears to be Interstate 5 through Washington and Oregon, says a report released this week by the Kirkland-based INRIX data company. Runners-up are I-95 from Jacksonville to Miami, Florida, I-75 from Valdosta, Georgia to Miami, I-70 from Utah to Kansas, and I-85 from Northeast Georgia to Greensboro, North Carolina, where companies could reduce the cost to move freight once self-driving vehicle technologies are ready. I-5 carries a lot of freight, is less congested than several other U.S. freeways. The corridor is long, some 637 miles between Vancouver, B.C. and Eureka, California, and high incident rates throughout I-5 can cause sudden slowdowns. Autonomous trucks may be more valuable in avoiding secondary crashes if they can see farther ahead and reduce speed sooner than human drivers. Trucking companies report a national shortage of commercial long-haul drivers. Experiments are underway in a few states, including Colorado, where a self-driving beer truck covered 132 miles last year while a human on board moved about the cab. And Mayor Gregor Robertson's office is the epicenter of another email scandal. The Breaker exclusively confirmed that Robertson has used a Gmail account for years, despite warnings from the Information and Privacy Commissioner to stop it. It took most of 2018 for The Breaker to extract more than 300 pages of emails from City Hall's FOI office. Some of Robertson's messages are heavily censored and allude to financial situations at City Hall. One mentions former Vision donor Chip Wilson, the Lululemon founder who lives in a $75 million Point Grey mansion. Robertson also used Gmail to receive the tweets that were ghostwritten for him by his aide, Kevin Quinlan. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. The political battleground that Facebook has become is harmful to democracy. That is according to the Victoria whistleblower, whose revelations of widespread data misuse shook the social media giant earlier this year. Christopher Wiley told the Extraordinary Future 2018 Investment Conference in Vancouver on September 19th that Facebook's claim to be a community is an illusion. Wiley, the former research director for SCL Group, talked about how social media has been weaponized against citizens. Here is part of Wiley's conversation with Blake Corbett, the managing director of PI Financial Corporation at the Vancouver Convention Center.
When Cambridge Analytica did this, collected this data and on the people that they were taking surveys and questions and quizzes and things like that, and others in the entire social web, were they exploiting a loophole? Were they just doing this better than everybody else? Or were they doing something quite different? And are there others out there doing it now?
Is it a loophole or a feature? I mean, think about it, right? Look at the layout of Facebook, the physical layout of Facebook. You've got a likes page, right? When was the last time you scrolled through the 300 pages on your likes page? When was the time you went to your friends and clicked on likes and then just kept scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, right? These likes actually serve no purpose in their display, right? But they make it really easy to take because it's all structured. And when you take Facebook data, that data then gets used in a database for targeting on Facebook, right? So there is a perverse incentive on some of these platforms to create systems that are leaky because it doesn't really serve much of a commercial purpose. Well, at least if you're thinking of short-termism, right? It's like saying like seatbelts aren't really needed in cars. But you know what? You know what seatbelts have done? They've maintained consumer confidence in the auto industry because they kill less people, right? And so this is where I think Facebook really doesn't understand that actually creating safe systems and creating privacy by design as a starting point, and also transparency by design. You know, one of the perverse things about Facebook, like, they always call themselves a community, but like it's not, because you can't actually see what's happening. So, you know, inherent in like a community, right? Like what we're doing here, you've got a platform, somebody talks, everybody understands and hears what that person is saying. If that's bullshit, someone can call me out. Like if I'm a candidate, right? And I say something, I lie, right? Like, you know, news shock, lying happens all the time in politics, but the difference is that the media can call me out, or an opposition candidate can call me out, or civil society, or the members of the public can call me out. And also, that community has a shared understanding and a common understanding of what's actually being said, right? But the difference about what's happening on Facebook or other social platforms is, rather than me just speaking in public in a public forum, I can go to each and every single one of you and I can whisper in your ear something. And I can whisper in your ear something with the benefit of having followed you around months on end, read your conversations, listened in to what you say, what you're interested in, what you watch, what you listen to, and know exactly the types of things that you connect with and you don't connect with. But I can also do it invisibly. So no one in this community actually even sees me going around whispering into people's ears. And also, I may not look like who I actually am. So you don't even know sometimes that someone is whispering something into your ear. And when you think about the effects on our democracy, right, it degrades or eviscerates the public forum, the public nature. This quote-unquote community that Facebook has created is actually the degradation of our public forum, because you can't actually see what happens.
And in those whispers, you're not necessarily saying the same thing to each person, are you?
No.
Whereas somebody on the platform, everybody hears this, what we're speaking.
Disinformation is like magic. It feels real. And you enjoy what you see. You enjoy being deceived because it's something that you want to see. That's what the power of disinformation is. And that's what makes it so dangerous, is that people enjoy receiving it. It's not like you're receiving something that you don't like. It wouldn't work that way.
Indeed. And now you're described as, and you are a whistleblower for the events that occurred and brought
this right,
out.
Right, blow them whistles.
You blew that whistle. Can you take a minute just to describe for us what it's been like for you as a whistleblower? An example of something that you've had to go through. Done.
Girl.
If one good example.
Do we have an hour? We don't. The Guardian approached me, and I originally was an anonymous source for their early reporting on Cambridge Analytica. They actually were investigating Brexit to begin with, and led them to Cambridge Analytica because actually, by the way, British Columbia, Victoria, there was a company in Victoria that caused Brexit. 40% of all vote leave spending went to a tiny little company that was actually a subsidiary of Cambridge Analytica in Victoria, BC, that was recently ruled all illegal. And so they started looking at all these sort of Canadian players in this company that led them to Cambridge Analytica. That led them to me. Because they kept talking to people and they said, oh, if you want to understand what's happening, you got to talk to this guy, Chris. So anyway, I give them a bunch of documents which I nicked, because when I left, I was like, oh, the shit's like really fucked up. And so I just kind of took everything. And those articles became the most read thing last year on The Guardian. So obviously people were interested and wanted to hear more, because it talked about all these new dynamics of how digital intersects with our democracy and all these like new kinds of players or entities that, you know, previously we never even had to think about information warfare in an election unless we were like Zimbabwe. And so they came to me and they asked me, you know, people, there's more sort of credibility to a story when somebody comes out with a name and a face and they actually can talk about it. But the problem was that after they put out those stories, Guardian got sued left, right, and center. And there was another company that was involved in the story called Palantir. Palantir was started by Peter Thiel, and its seed investment was from InQtel, which is the CIA's venture fund. And so all the stuff that, for example, Edward Snowden was talking about actually was, a lot of it was built by this company, Palantir. And the whole beginning section of one of the main articles that they wrote was talking about Palantir's involvement and how Sophie Schmidt, who's the daughter of Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google, was working at SCL Group and introduced SCL Group to Palantir. She sues with a totally spurious claim, but it was going to be really expensive, so The Guardian took it all down. And so they come to me and they say, hey, we want you to be like the face of this thing. And I go, girl, you just took that down. You don't stand up. So you want me to like ruin my life? Fuck no, right? I said like, look, there's been tons of stories on like data breaches. Like, oh, you know, they kind of go on like page 8 of the technology section, and it's like, oh, like half the country's like MasterCard information was stolen, and people go, oh, that's too bad. Next, right? And so I go, like, there's been lots of these stories, and they don't necessarily make an impact because of how they're talked about. So anyway, I made a deal with them. I said, hey, you gotta find a partner, newspaper, to back you, and that partner needs to be in the United States where you've got the First Amendment, where you can't be sued for things that you can be sued for in the UK. So I made them grit their teeth and talk to their main rival, their frenemy in journalism, the New York Times. So then they formed a partnership with the New York Times to co-publish. And I also said, I don't want any political journalists reporting on this, and I don't want any tech journalists reporting on it, because they report shit that is inaccessible to most of the public. So The Guardian gave the story to the arts and culture section of The Guardian, a team of all women, who typically report about museums, music albums, etc. And that was one of the most important things that they did, because these were women who could barely use Facebook, let alone talk about algorithms and machine learning. But that was great because they were actually the audience And so they had to learn the story and then distill it into something that actually mattered to normal people, right? But when I was talking to New York Times and Guardian, they kept on saying this is like, it was all documented. There's thousands of pages of documents that I handed over because I just nicked everything. And they kept on saying, like, this is so documented, and it's the New York Times and Guardian, right? They don't cut corners when it comes to validation of facts, right? You have to have, like, five pieces of corroborating evidence. Anyway, so that's when we went to Channel 4. Channel 4 is the sort of punchier version of BBC, and they do undercover operations. And we went to Channel 4 and we said, look, if you get these guys in a room, they will tell you what they do. So we went through this whole undercover operation, went through the head of the legal of all the channel, and we finally got authorization to do it. We had to plan out, like, we had to get actors, we had to plan out the whole thing. And
a bona fide sting operation.
Yeah, a sting, yeah. And there was cameras everywhere. Like, I got to go and meet this dude in some, like, random empty building in London who, like, supplied, you know, would you get hidden cameras? Like, those guys are all a little bit weird. And you know, it just has his wares on the table, and it's like all these little cameras. You can put cameras in everything, man. So anyway, so we had the first meeting. It was in a private room, and they were, like, very, like, cagey, and they're like, oh, don't, just leave it to us. Like, whoa, you know. And I said, like, they probably think that the room is bugged, because it was. And so they decided that we should do it in a restaurant, because if you go to a restaurant and you let them pick the table, it's less likely it's going to be bugged because you got to pick the table. So they rented out an entire restaurant. Everyone in that restaurant was actors. The people, the ladies beside the handbags, actors, right? The waiter, actor, right? And there were cameras in fucking everything. That risotto that she's eating, camera. Handbag, camera, right? And that's when they talked. And so they said, you know, okay, we'll work for you, client. And here's the premise of the sort of background of the operation was we picked Sri Lanka because it was close enough to their Indian office, but still labyrinthine enough. I mean, Sri Lanka politics is so convoluted that you can barely figure out what's what, right? And the premise was somebody from the former government had their accounts frozen, which was a common problem. And so he needed this minister to reopen his account so he could take all the millions, and there'd be a cut for whoever could do that. So of course, their first proposition is, well, of course, in this situation, I like blonde Ukrainian hookers, we'll fly them in, we'll set up a sting. It was very meta, because they talked about a sting and a sting. And we'll get these sex workers to put him in a compromising position, we'll film him taking bribes, and then we'll take all of that and give it to the minister, and the minister will definitely open up your account in that, because we'll blackmail them. And we've got all kinds of private intelligence firms that can do all of that, don't worry. And we had that all on camera. And so we had this situation now that it was lawsuit proof. And now it was even more credible because you've got all these people that we're talking about with these sort of extreme allegations, albeit well-documented, now admitting to it on camera.
Well, I think as shocking as the whole thing was, that's even more surprising. It sounds like it's straight out of a movie. But I want to thank you, Chris, for sitting with us and telling us all about that.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
That was whistleblower Christopher Wiley with Blake Corbett at the Extraordinary Future 2018 conference in Vancouver on September 19th. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Good Samaritans, who came to the rescue in downtown Vancouver on the morning of September 21st, after a carjacking that led to several collisions. The suspect, a 27-year-old man, pepper-sprayed several people near the CBC building, but construction worker Ben Smith came to the rescue and tackled him before he was arrested by police. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Well, that's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of September 23rd, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on September 23rd in 1806, U.S. Army explorers Meriwether Lewis and William Clark returned to St. Louis after they explored the Pacific Northwest? The trek lasted more than 2 years. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. Thanks to some of our supporters like Quan Lee, Randy Sogstad, James Plett, Spruce Hill Contracting, Daryl Greer, Barbara May, Elvio Chies, John Kennedy, and Dave and Burnaby. For more information on how you can join them, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.